You're listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. It is such a great honor to introduce Lady Antonia Fraser tonight. She will be joined in conversation by Howard A. Rodman, who is the professor of screenwriting at USC's School of Cinematic Arts. Howard, who is a son of Bed-Stuy, born to royalty there, wrote the films Savage Grace, nominated for Best Screenplay at the 2009 Spirit Awards, August, starring Josh Hartnett and David Bowie, and one of my favorite films, the wonderful Joe Gould's Secret. Lady Antonia Fraser is the author of many internationally best-selling historical works, including Love and Louis XIV, Marie Antoinette, which many of you, I'm sure, saw as the film by Sofia Coppola, The Wives of Henry VIII, Mary, Queen of Scots, and Faith and Treason, The Gunpowder Plot. She's received many awards for her work, which have been praised for her fluent storytelling, her vivid characterization, and evocative historical background. Must You Go? My Life with Harold Pinter begins with the initial meeting between Fraser and Pinter when Fraser was the wife of a member of parliament and a mother of six, and Pinter was married to a distinguished actress. The affair proceeds, joyous, dangerous, unavoidable, and ultimately becomes a 33-year marriage of true minds. Lady Antonia's book is based on the diaries she kept during her relationship with Harold Pinter, and it is a love story, an intimate portrait of a great writer, and a wonderfully full description of the deep pleasures and comforts of married love. In her preface, Lady Antonia quotes from Shakespeare, Richard II's courtier, "O call back yesterday, bid time return." Writing this memoir, she writes, was her means of doing so. Please join me in welcoming Lady Antonia Fraser and Howard Rodman to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Ken and Louise for those lovely, lovely words, and mostly I'd like to thank all of you for being here. I don't know if you've ever seen a question and answer session in a room this size with no audience, but that would be dismal, and this is much better, so I really thank you for making this possible. And mostly I would like to thank Lady Antonia for coming here, and I know how crowded her schedule is, for making time for doing this evening tonight. To quote a line which recurs many times in the book, tonight I feel like the luckiest man on earth, and I feel honored and very pleased to be here. So thank you.
I thought you were going to quote another line, which Harold was fond of quoting, "You have to take the rough with the smooth." That's also a good line.
That's a better line, but I wouldn't have the nerve to say it. So. I'd like to start kind of just slightly before the narrative of your book starts, which is very early January 1975. You write biographies which are very well received and justifiably so. You have a husband who's a member of parliament, even if his politics are not the politics of your family. You have six glorious children, and one might assume that your life would continue on that trajectory for a long time, and then you went out of doors on January 8th, and what happened?
Well, what happened? Shall I read it to you?
That would be wonderful if you would be willing to do that.
Yes. Swapping specs. Is there anyone else in this audience who has two pairs of specs? If so, they will sympathize. Good. I'm glad I got friends. This is my diary entry for the 8th of January, 1975. A very enjoyable dinner party at Rachel Billington, my sister, the novelist, and Kevin's house in Addison Avenue. A long and convivial table. Kevin was a director. I was slightly disappointed not to sit next to the playwright, because we'd been to the first night of a revival of the birthday party. He looked full of energy, with black curly hair and pointed ears like a satyr. Gradually, the guests filtered away. My neighbours offered me a lift up the road. "Wait a minute," I said. "I must just say goodbye to Harold Pinter and tell him I enjoyed the play. I haven't said hello all evening." They waited at the door. I went over to where Harold was sitting. "Wonderful play, marvellous acting. Now I'm off." He looked at me with those amazing, extremely bright black eyes. "Must you go?" he said. I thought of home, my lift, taking the children to school the next morning, the exhausting past night in the sleeper from Scotland, my projected biography of Charles II. "No, it's not absolutely essential," I said. About 2:30 in the morning, poor Rachel and Kevin were visibly exhausted, and we were the last guests. In the end, it was Harold who gave me a lift home, in a white car with the driver. He never drove at night, having been found. His word, weaving in Regent's Park. I offered him coffee. I actually gave him champagne. He stayed until 6 o'clock in the morning with extraordinary recklessness. But of course, the real recklessness was mine. So that's my story.
There's a story that Billy Wilder once ran into a friend of his and said, "What are you up to?" And his friend said, "I'm writing a love story." And Wilder said, "What keeps them apart?" And so I think we know some of the externals that kept you apart at the beginning, which is that you had full and complete lives. You were, to use the delicious phrase of your book, your family had an interest in keeping you approximately married to you.
I think that it's very difficult for me. I mean, to put myself back 36 years, and to not so much to remember, because I'm a historian, so I remember, but to put myself in the mindset of 7th of January 1975, because what happened afterwards was so extraordinary and wonderful and long. I mean, we were both married to each other twice as long as we were married to other people. Things, you know, I know the relativity of time is difficult, but actually we were both married, interestingly, the first time on the same day within 2 days. And as somebody said to me, and on the second, your second marriage, you got married on exactly the same day. And I was rather dumb. I was sort of trying to think it out. Wait a minute. And that was 33 extremely happy years.
I think whenever two people get together recklessly, there's always external obstacles to overcome.
Of
and
course.
Baggage that one has to honor and jettison. But I'm much more interested in talking about when you first began to fall in love, or began to know that you had no choice but to fall in love. What were the internal obstacles? What were the voices of your heart that were coming into play here and making it either difficult or essential?
I think I mean, my main memory of that time, which I relate, I should just say that the book is on two levels. One is, and it's quite clear which is which. One is my diary, which I kept mainly at breakfast the next day, and the other is my commentary on it in 2009. So, going my diary, I'm not sure that I can pinpoint the moment, but what is absolutely clear is that Harold was completely determined. He had, I mean, he was an extraordinary person, I don't need to tell you. He had this sense of destiny, and when I sometimes said, well, what would have happened when you said, must you go? And I said, well, I've got to take the kids to school, go to the supermarket, write Charles II, I'm afraid I must go home. What would have happened? And he said, we would have found each other. It was destiny. And I'm not so confident about things as Harold was. You know, I thought, it's Robert Frost, isn't it? The road not taken. Yeah. Well, we don't know the road not taken.
Right, but those of us who write spend most of our waking days thinking about the road not taken.
Yes. Well, I don't know. Do you? Do you really spend a lot of time thinking about the road? I know he's supposed to be interviewing me, but you know, I can...
Well, I'm one of the... I can dish it out, but I can't take it, so I will very respectfully decline to answer that question, and instead... One of the things that I was very moved by in your telling of this extraordinary relationship and long-lived marriage was the fact that not only did Harold Pinter adore you, not only did he woo you, not only did he win you, but he wrote poems to you.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that was the most marvelous thing. And my friends... You know, Aunt Friends Lovely would say, well, Antonio, I don't really envy you being married to Harold as a bit, but I envy you the poems.
There are some lines that you quote in the book. I think the four lines are, everything we do connects the space between death and me and you. And then there's a sort of story in the punctuation of those lines.
Yes, when he wrote it, I hope I'm going to get it right. There's someone here who can help me if I don't. I know the place, it is true. Everything we do corrects the space between death and me and you. And when Harold wrote it, it was very, very early on in our lives together. He had a comma after death and me, comma, and you. And I objected. And said, there is no comma between the death. The comma should come after death. We had an argument. Everything we do corrects the space between death, comma, and me and you. Anyway, we compromised, as so often. So it's death and me and you, as you will see it. I relate.
Well, I think sometimes that's what a successful marriage is, which is just a sort of a commitment on both parties to repunctuate.
Yes.
One of the things that becomes quickly evident as one reads the saga of this extraordinary marriage is the amazing swirl of people eating, drinking, traveling, fam holidays, and glamorous dinners that the two of you inhabited. I mean, for those of you who've not yet had the pleasure of reading the book, everyone there was there. I mean, there's Salman Rushdie and his bodyguards sleeping in the basement. There's, or in the studio next door. There's the young guide to Turkey, Orhan Pamuk. There's Warren Beatty behaving like a cad. There's...
No, he was lovely.
Oh, I'm sorry. Behaving charmingly. Forgive me, I correct. There's Steve McQueen with a beard. There's V.S. Pritchett and V.S. Naipaul. There's, you know, A.J. P. Taylor and E.S. Thompson. Anyone with two or three initials you've ever read. And I think part of what I was wondering when I wasn't simply just swimming in delight or shaking my head in befuddled envy was, how do you maintain a marriage, let alone a life, let alone a writing life, while being so happily social?
No, you see, this is one of the things that, which I think is a difficulty about a diary, if you're going to publish it, which I've done. You see, what I didn't write in my diary is, stayed home, I watched Mad Men, Harold said, what, tosh, and went and watched cricket. I don't write that. Nor do I write the next night, stayed home, watched Mad Men, and Harold said, you know, you don't relate those evenings, which are just as important in the warp and woof of married life, but you don't bother to write it down. So it does seem as if we never stopped socializing with madmen. I mean, sorry, with cricketers, you know. and actually, I do have to say that an awful lot of the names you've just mentioned, I mean, you've mentioned Orhan Pamuk, were the Nobel winner. But actually, when Harold and Arthur Miller met him, the point was that these two distinguished playwrights went to Turkey, sent by Penn, you know, on a mission because writers were being imprisoned and tortured. And they were met by an obscure young writer, I don't know what he'd written, was quite shy, who happened to be called Orhan Pamuk. And Harold told me the name and I wrote it down. I was very interested in what he had to say. Now, you may say that the biographer knew what would happen, but it's not really true. I just wrote it down. So it isn't really about noting a Nobel Prize winner. And, you know, it's just my absolute genius of a prediction.
Right. When there's actually a line in the book which I think is wonderful. Pamuk won the Nobel Prize for writing the year after Harold Pinter did.
Yes, yeah.
And Pinter was called up for a reaction, and he thought said that he thought it was well deserved and would have happened sooner had someone not stood in the way last year. Yeah.
No, because actually the morning, little did we know, Harold was going to win the Nobel Prize, the 13th of October, 2005. That morning, idly over breakfast, looking at the papers, one of us said, oh, Orhan might win the Nobel Prize. And we thought, what a good thing, because he was in terrible trouble, as usual, with the authorities. And the one thing was we had absolutely no idea that Harold would. People said afterwards, oh, well, you must have had a lot of notice. You were very, very clever to stay so quiet. 20 minutes notice. Extraordinary. Yeah.
Anyway, I'm assuming that there were nights of laundry that don't get mentioned in the diary, but from the outside it certainly seems. There's a word you use a couple of times which I love, which is Bonhamus,
yes.
Describing the kind of life.
Yeah.
When I first read it, I thought it meant of or pertaining to the drummer for Led Zeppelin. But in fact, it means to have a life filled with conviviality and good spirit. And certainly you've managed to do that. But I want to kind of segue from that discussion to another one, which is, although you claim that this is a diary that happened to get published, perhaps with some hindsight and some revisions, and with some marginalia and comments from Harold Pinter as well incorporated into it.
Yes, I mean, but no revisions, I have to say. Everything that I print as being in the diary is in the diary. And you may say, why didn't you sort of vivify it? The answer is, historians honour, if you like, something in me. I couldn't pretend something's in my diary if it's not. Just as I couldn't write in my diary something untrue. It's not in me. I don't mean I'm this perfect person, but I just couldn't do that. So everything that is printed is in the diary, in the diary.
Now, did you, contemporaneously, did you make separate time for your diary writing and your historical writing, or was one a break from the other? Or did you, as you say, Naipaul did, you know, do one on typewriter and one longhand?
No, not at all. Well, not really. I started keeping my diary when I delivered Mary Queen of Scots, the manuscript, in 1968. It had been the focus of my life for so long, the thing that I wanted to do. And I felt so depressed after I'd handed it in. Postnatal, I guess, you know, was the words that came to mind. And I thought, well, I must write. So I just sat down and wrote it. It was nothing to do with my work. It was never work.
I still want to ask you questions about writing. There's a sentence from your book, which the book is full of sentences to adore, and one of them is, I love hearing details of writer's craft as cannibals eat the brains of cleverer cannibals to become clever.
It's rather disgusting. I wish I hadn't written that.
But I when you are researching, writing, I'm talking about now your biographies as opposed to this, which you claim isn't writerly, do you have a set number of words per day? Do you have a set time of the day? Do you have the kinds of rules and regulations that some of us enforce for ourselves in order to see that the work gets done?
Absolutely. When I was writing, I mean, I would stick to 9:30 to 12:30 when my children were young. You know, when they were in their prams, cradles, schools, you know, they tell wicked stories. Like I said, you can interrupt me if you've broken a leg, but not before, which is totally untrue, you know. They have fun inventing that kind of thing. Now, of course, I mean, any mother and, quickly say father, you have to have, if you work at home, which I did, you've got to have a discipline. And my daughter, Natasha Fraser Capasoni, some of you may have known because she lived here for a bit, she made a notice, this is true, which to put on the door, which said, nobody allowed, spelt A-L-O-U-D, not even you, otherwise no conversation, spelt any old how, no pocket money, and worst of all, no mother. I've still got it.
Are you someone whose first drafts are relatively clean, or do you spend as much time rewriting as you spend writing, or are the two processes not separate for you?
I write quite, this, we're talking about history, I write quite quickly and to keep the narrative flow. After all, it happened. One thing happened after another, you know. And then I rewrite and try to sort of, if it's not got a shape, try to give it a shape.
Two, because this is a library evening and because we are in a very magnificent library, I'm wondering if you could just talk a bit about both the role of research in your writing, particularly the historical and biographical stuff, the joys of it, and also how you make the transition from the reading of source material to the incorporation of it and the writing of it.
Well, the way I do it, I think that I can only tell you how I do it, because I think there is many ways of doing it and the end product is all. I take endless notes. I've got these pattern notebooks I used to get from Florence at hideous expense, and now I get from a place in Wiltshire, which as far as I'm concerned, I'm supporting, you know, this little village in Wiltshire called Compton Marbling. And I take all these notes, and with capital letters in on the right, little boxes, where I think they might fit in. And then I sort of keep on doing this, and then at a given moment, possibly when my publisher says, hello, how about something called a book, you know, then I read it through and structure it. This, to me, is very important, the structuring process, where I form it, I sort of see how it might be. And then once I've done that, then I write like a bat out of hell. And then I rewrite.
The book is a lovely and touching and moving story of a marriage, but in addition to that, it is also a very fine-grained portrait of Harold Pinter, and there are a couple of things that the book emphasizes that I'd like to talk about, if I might.
Mm.
I think one of them is that I think particularly in the United States, there's a feeling that Harold Pinter's politics were the thing that he was successful in spite of. And I know people who have often voiced the opinion of, oh, if he hadn't just spent quite so much time marching around with placards in front of embassies. But the portrait you paint is of someone whose belief in social justice and whose belief in equality was really inseparable from the work, and it gave force and strength to the work, even as the work gave its grounding to those activities. And I'm wondering if you might talk about the role of the social commitment of Harold Pinter in terms of how what it played in his work.
Well, I think you've absolutely put your finger on it. What Harold was against. He was in favour of social justice, and he was against authoritarianism in all its forms. And I should say that when we were first together in 1975, and for many years afterwards until... when was the Velvet Revolution? 1989, wasn't it? The collapse of the communists. But Harold endlessly demonstrated, and the embassies he marched outside were Soviet embassies and Czech embassies, so that he didn't... although he didn't spare countries which he felt were being authoritarian, it was absolutely across the board. He did a tremendous amount for Soviet Jews, which certainly was necessary. And then all his work, Czechoslovakia, Václav Havel, at the time when we first knew him, well, Harold knew him because he was a playwright, but he was an obscure man who'd been in prison. So, Harold was... It was across the board. And although in later years he denounced American foreign policy, and I repeat, foreign policy, never America, people sometimes make that mistake, he denounced British foreign policy a great deal more strongly, for a good reason that he voted in Britain. So really, he may have, oddly enough, called George Bush a war criminal, but what's that between friends? He called Tony Blair a major war criminal, you see. So just as he denounced various Soviet leaders and Turkish, Turkish people. So he, nobody was safe from his denunciation if they were in some way authoritarian and oppressed minorities like the Kurds. He was very active about the Kurds, and incidentally, very active about the Kurds in Iraq. So that's where his inclination was, to support minorities.
No, I mean, the sense one gets from the book is that it's not at all doctrinaire, and that it's not at all blind to the truths of oppression, wherever it may be. But that I think many of us, as Mel Brooks's Joan of Arc says, or as Mel Brooks's Joan of Arc's husband says, "Oh, you go save France, I'll wash up," and that doesn't seem to be his level of commitment. Seemed to be far stronger than that, and far more part of the spine of who he was.
Yes, but it's an argument. There are endless discussions of Harold's dramatic works and his works by professors and everything down to mere readers. And sometimes people decide Harold's work is entirely political, and sometimes they decide it's not. I think if you take a play like The Birthday Party, it's perfectly easy to argue that it's a tremendously political play, because here is Stanley, who's sort of every man, being oppressed. He's oppressed by Goldberg, he's oppressed by McCann, he sure is. You could argue it's a political play if you want to, or you can just say it's a very good play, a mysterious play. So I think Harold, generally, people used to stop us at the theatre because his plays are done so much in exams in England, and people very respectfully would say, "Mr. Pinter," and I knew what was coming, "my son, stroke daughter, is doing The Birthday Party for A stroke O level, and I wonder if I could just ask you." And Harold would say, "It means whatever he thinks it means."
No cheat sheet. you recount in the book a conversation you were having with Cherie Blair, who was at that point the wife of the prime minister, and just sort of noticing wryly that, were the situations reversed and were your husband the prime minister, her husband would be in the dock for war crimes.
Well, it was rather embarrassing. She's very nice, Cherie Blair. She doesn't get does she get a good press here? She doesn't get press in England.
Better here, maybe.
Yes, yeah. I mean, she's admirable. She's very, very troubled background, and she made it as a distinguished lawyer. And she was doing a programme about British prime ministers' wives, and number 10 Downing Street, and she asked me along to give my views. I didn't really have any views, actually, but I was quite prepared to give them whatever they were. And then she asked this question, saying, she obviously asked to everybody she interviewed, without possibly quite thinking about it, as you said. She said, "Antonio, what would Harold have done if he'd been Prime Minister?" And I felt this bubble coming out of my head. He would indict your husband as a war criminal. But I slapped the bubble down and said he would have taken all the boxes at Lord's, our great cricket place, in order to enjoy the test matches, which was also true.
One of the other activities that Harold Pinter engaged in that I also think is typically given shorter shrift than it deserves is his screenwriting activity. I mean,
yes, absolutely. And he would agree with you. He took screenwriting extremely seriously. He thought it was an art. Well, it is an art. And he got cross when his friends sort of said, "Well, I must do a film to paint the house." It annoyed him, he thought, and he was very proud of the many films that he wrote.
Yes. Now, the sense that one gets from the book is not sort of, you know, that's the day job or that's how the rent gets paid, that there's every bit as much engagement in the screenwriting as in the playwriting, and absolutely no condescension toward the medium.
Oh, not at all. No. Absolutely not. He was always... I mean, to take only one example, The French Lieutenant's Woman, I remember Harold saying one day that Carol Rice, the very distinguished director of Czech origin, he said, "Carol Rice just rang me, and it seems that after various sort of boss shots, I don't know the history of it, but he may be able to direct The French Lieutenant's Woman, and I'm terribly excited. I'd love to write the screenplay." And he had a very, very happy time doing it. It's a great movie, isn't it?
There's a short story by Martin Amis which presumes a world in which screenwriters gather in sort of soggy cafes, you know, sort of whinging to one another, and people who write sonnets get paid $1 million per poem. And there's a bunch of screenwriters in a cafe complaining about a former member of their circle who had just been given a very large advance to write "Twas," a sequel to "Tis." Actually, a prequel, I'm sorry. But yeah. I also get the sense from the book, you know, you had mentioned cricket, that too was not a casual part of his life or a part without real investment, both the playing of it and the kind of...
I don't think Harold did casual, to be quite honest, if he wasn't interested in something, you know. He wasn't. No, he loved cricket. He really adored it and took a keen interest in it. He played it quite late. He also... played tennis, squash. He loved that. Sometimes takes people by surprise, but he loved. Well, he was an athlete, you know. He liked all of that.
One of the things that I want to talk about is the ways, and I think this is apparent just because of the chronological compression of the diaries. Because, as you say, you've left out the boring bits. The way that even as time is running out for you, the relationship seems to deepen and deepen just at the point when you think it might fall apart under the strains or give in to the inevitability of that very loudly ticking clock. The love seems to get more profound and the faith seems to increase. And I'm wondering if that's something that you were aware of at the time and if you might...
Well,
you would be comfortable talking about.
Yes, no, I am. I don't think I ever thought, to be honest, it would give way under the strain. That didn't occur to me. I mean, it's not how I see life. And I think very few people would find a relationship giving way. But it certainly deepened. You know, I think I'm sure. I'd like to think I was alone in having to care for someone as... phrases over 7 years, but I'm quite sure I'm not. And of course it deepens, you know, it's the eternal verities, aren't it? But also, although you would so much rather this person was not going through these, in Harold's case, successive ordeals. At the same time, there's a bit of you which thinks, well, at least I can do something. I can do something. It must be awful for people who, for whatever reason, can't do anything for someone, you know. Now, remind me that, is it Raymond Carver, short story, what they talk about when they talk about love? Mm-hmm. Someone, correct me if I'm going to get this wrong, but isn't the title from a man in hospital, and he in a terrible state, and he gets his bed pulled so he could see his wife, who's also in the hospital, just for a moment. Is that the story? Anybody?
Audience, please.
I've got it wrong. Or you don't like Raymond Carver.
Let's assume, for the sake of this evening, that that's exactly what happens in the story. But, yes. Something else that is not a main subject of the book, but that I found very moving, was that in addition to the marriage and the commitment deepening as the story goes on, your faith also seems to deepen. And it, because I think we all know a lot of people, particularly if they marry outside their faith, particularly if they spend a lot of their time engaged in worldly causes as opposed to causes of the world afterwards, their faith falls by the wayside or becomes a lesser component of their life, whereas it seems to have very much been a source of not just sustenance, but of some kind of very deep renewing spirit for you.
I have a slightly odd background in the sense that neither of my parents were Catholics. They came from Protestant or nonconformist Unitarian background. I became a Catholic after my father became one and after my mother when I was 14, which is rare because people are either cradle Catholics like my children or distinguished Catholic converts like Graham Greene, you know, or Evelyn Waugh, and I was none of them. And of course, with me, I'm always tremendously interested in Catholic history. I mean, Faith and Treason, the Gunpowder Plot, came out of my interest in the Catholic Church. It's an extraordinary story, and I cannot think why it's not seized on as a film, instead of which there was an option, and the film company said, nowadays in the age of terrorism, this subject is not suitable, whereas I thought it was extremely suitable. But that's by the way. I think Harold and I had long discussed, he was an extremely spiritual person, while having no overt faith. He was 1,000,000% Jewish and very proud of it, but gave up his faith after making his bar mitzvah, to which, this is his story to me, to which the obvious question, why did you make your bar mitzvah? He said, so I could get the present. Now, was that true? I don't know. And then the story got more exciting still because much later we all had to choose our favourite childhood book for a charity to do something about it, favour a first start for children, you know, something really good. And I chose our Ireland story and people chose Anne of Green Gables, you know how it goes. And Harold chose Ulysses. And I said, what? How could you choose Ulysses? And then I sort of came back and said, but how did you buy Ulysses? Because, you know, his parents, God rest them, lived in a house without books. You know, they worked hard. His father was in a tailoring factory. Where'd you get it? And Harold triumphantly said, I bought it with my bar mitzvah money. I just for a moment, I thought the boy who bought Ulysses with his bar mitzvah money. And then I thought, it's a wonderful story. Don't go there.
Whenever there are households, which are, I think, what we call in the United States, you know, two career couples where yes. both the husband and wife work, there are always strains involved, compromises involved, tensions involved, and serendipities involved, too. But when you have a marriage, and I think many of us are familiar with this, where not only do both parts of the marriage work, but they work doing kind of sort of the same thing, there are always sort of questions that arise. I mean, I know people where husband and wife both write, but they are so terrified of that fact that they are incredibly ginger about reading each other's material. I know other couples where both of them write and have actually ended up contributing greatly to each other's voice and have kind of merged in terms of the authorial voice that each one of them has. And I was just wondering if you could talk about the ways in which you reacted to and were part of the process of Harold Pinter's writing and vice versa.
Well, I wasn't part of the process of his writing. The process of Harold's writing, which I was extremely interested in, I found when I went back to look at my diaries, the process of Harold's writing was the process of Harold's unique mind, and I didn't really play any part in it at all. I mean, it's very interesting. Unlike the screenwriting, which we discussed, where he wrote in a disciplined way, he only ever wrote a play if he got an idea, an image, and I sort of wrote them all down when we were together. So that was him. He was extremely helpful to me as an editor because he had a great, won't be surprised to hear, sense of language. And I don't like to use a word. If you take sanguine, I don't like to use sanguine twice. You know, it's a great word, but you don't. And Harold had an extraordinary sense of where and when. But I think it's important to realise, and I don't know about your friends, but you see, I was 42 and Harold was 44 when we came together. And I was a well-known, I'm glad to say, historical biographer. And Harold was, and I'm quoting the London Times, arguably the best living playwright. And Harold always added, and plenty of people are arguing about him. So we had nothing to prove to each other, you know. I mean, I think, of course, I've had masses of friends who risen up in their careers together. And I agree, you know, it can be tricky. I've known cases where it's been very tricky, cases where it went exactly as you said, where it's sort of helped. But it was slightly different with us.
But you always had, you know, to use Virginia Woolf's phrase, a room of your own.
Yes, I'm the eldest of eight children. And my definition of happiness is to be alone in a room in a house full of people.
Whereas Harold Pinter's idea was to be alone in the house next door or the structure next door.
Yes, he did buy a house at the end of the garden. I think for some extraordinary reason he found my teenage son and his friends playing rock music. He found it curiously inconvenient, but there you are.
One of the lovely poems you quote in the book is not a poem of Harold Pinter, but there are some lines that I think many of us probably know. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediment. Love is not love which alters when in
alteration finds. Yes, I do quote those. I think I quote it quite late on when Harold was going through terrible things. He had three mortal illnesses and survived all but the third one, and I do quote them. And I think, well, in the end, Shakespeare's the greatest, isn't it? You know, yeah. I mean, it says it all, really. That's why I quoted them. And, of course, the very last lines of the book are by Shakespeare. I end it when Harold died. I was with him. I was so fortunate to be there at that moment. And I then gave him a last kiss and quoted, "Good night, sweet prince," from Hamlet, you know. And so, in the end, Shakespeare.
I think when two people are together as successfully, as intimately, and as long as the two of you are together, there certainly are the physical structures of the marriage. Mm-hmm. And then there are ways in which there's a part of you that lives in him, and there's a part of him that lives in you. And my optimism and my faith is that that does not disappear with death,
I agree with you.
And I was wondering if you could talk about that part of Harold Pinter that is still within you, that still accompanies you, guides you, frustrates you, delights you, or just is simply there.
I think I was doing a dialogue, and rather less distinguished, very nice, because all dialogues are nice, and there was a question, and somebody asked from the back, it was a lady, but I couldn't really see, have you had any messages from Harold from the other side? And I said instinctively, I don't need to, because Harold is here with me, and that's what I feel. You know, and of course, I'm very lucky because to have lived with Harold, Harold is here. His plays are done all the time. I mean, I was very briefly in New York, able to see two plays and wonderful production. There's always something going on, and that's marvelous. I mean, not everybody is as lucky as me, and that sort of keeps him alive. But I suppose, in a way, writing my book kept him alive for me.
I'd like to open this up to questions. I think there are microphones there. Before I do, if you'll allow me just a moment of kind of special pleadings. When I was in high school in January of 1967, there's someone you may know, Joe Frank, who's a Los Angeles radio personality on Sunday mornings, does very sort of dark, warped, surreal tales early on a Sunday morning. And in 1967, he was my high school English teacher. Basically, there were a lot of supremely overqualified young men who wanted a deferment from the draft and went into the profession of teaching. The war caused great destruction and devastation, but young people of my generation benefited mightily because of the stream of really bright people into the school system. And there's a tradition if you grow up in or around New York where, you know, your senior high school English teacher takes you to the city and you eat a bad meal at a French restaurant with onion soup, and then they take you to see The Sound of Music or The Music Man or something like that. Well, that's generally what happens, but this was Joe Frank, and he took us to see The Homecoming. I've since looked this up to confirm my memory, the production with Ian Holm as Lenny. I believe directed by Peter Hall.
Absolutely directed by Peter Hall, yeah. And it won a Tony,
yeah.
I think, yeah.
But you have to imagine this bunch of 16-year-olds whose experience of theater was that of people bursting into bad song, all of a sudden seeing this. And I have to tell you, I had no idea theater could do that. I had no idea language could do that. I had no idea that the strangeness and the unknowability and the intractability and just the sheer amazingness of people I knew in real life could ever be depicted on a stage like that. And that evening shocked me and disturbed me and sent me off reeling into the night feeling deeply uncomfortable. And I'm not sure I would have become a writer or that I would be sitting here tonight were it not for that evening. So I just wanted to say publicly to kind of witness the fact that although we're talking about a rather glorious marriage, the ripples from the work that emanated from that, I think, have really touched us all.
Well, I find that very, very moving that you say that. I also find it extraordinary, as you've said, to take a lot of 16-year-olds to the homecoming.
Well, it's kind of like buying Ulysses with your bar mitzvah money.
Exactly. Well, exactly. You're quite right. And I myself feel about The Homecoming as if ever I go to it and I'm not shocked profoundly, and I can't tell you how many times I've seen it and how many different ways, there's something wrong with the production. It is a deeply shocking play, isn't it? It's tremendously written about and argued about. People argue that it's profoundly anti-feminist, then they argue it's profoundly feminist. Like all great plays, I think you can, you know, you take your choice, really. But I love the idea of these 16-year-olds.
Well, we didn't at the time. But look at us now. So.
Yeah. One point I'd like to make about The Homecoming, about the artistic imagination. The point of The Homecoming, beginning. It's about a family, about these brothers, one of whom, of course, is lit out and then comes back with a strange wife. But it's about family and the brothers. Harold was an only child and didn't have cousins or anything like that. And I'm making the point because people do, I mean, we all do it, try to see somebody's life in their work. But that's an example of, in no way was his life in that work.
Okay, thank you. We're going to now open it up to some questions from you folk, if there are any. Does anyone have anything they would like to ask Lady Antonia? Rebecca?
I wanted to ask you, if I might, about your own political trajectory. When you met Harold Pinter, I wondered what your own political views were and how they evolved over the course of your marriage.
My own political history, my parents went against their own background and were both Labour. And my background was my parents standing for Parliament and the Labour interest, and then my father became a Labour minister. I then married a Tory MP. So you can see already I'm covering quite a spectrum and never wished... I'm very interested in politics, but I never wished to be a politician. Perhaps if both your mother and your father stand for Parliament and you sit there saying, vote for Pakenham. Perhaps if you do that early on, you think there must be another life than this. But so that, in a way, my own feelings, really my interests were always in things like free speech. I mean, very early on, I campaigned against capital punishment in England when I was 18. And then very early on, I was a member of PAN in favour of dissidents and rights of free speech and all kinds of rights. So that's the sort of thing. I wasn't interested myself in taking part in party politics. So I guess that actually we were more similar, really, than it might seem from outside.
The question down there.
Thank you. You had a very high-profile father and first husband, and I'm just wondering how they reacted to your change of allegiance when you introduced Sir Harold Pinter into your family.
They didn't react at all well, but they didn't seem to have noticed that I was 42 and that they didn't react well to my first marriage either when I was 23. So you may say that... you can say, not to be naughty really, neither of my marriages were arranged marriages in any sense. But I've always been very independent, perhaps because I'm the eldest of eight, you know, and then my mother, wonderful person, so is my father. But really, if you're bringing up all these endless children, and I was, you know, I struck out and did what I cared to do. So it was a bit late when they started saying, so I didn't really pay much attention, actually.
there is a line in the book where you talk about your family wanting you to stay approximately married to you.
Yes. Idiots. I mean, sorry.
Let that be a lesson to everyone in the audience with children. Yes, back there is... right over there in the black sweater.
Lady Antonia, your diary entry was so extraordinarily literary. I'm wondering when you were writing your diary, were you aware at some point that it might be published? Were you thinking about its publication? Did you intend it always to be private?
Never. And it isn't particularly literary. I mean, I think that if you compare it with how I write history, it isn't particularly... It's rather badly written in my sprawly handwriting. And I never, ever thought it was a consolation, a friend, particularly a consolation when Harold was so ill. It was the person, you know, to whom I confided it. You know, you can't go about complaining publicly. That is not fair to anyone. You don't want to. But the diary, you know, can listen to anything. So it wasn't. It was a sort of relief, actually. And I'm very glad I did keep it. When I was writing this book, for about 6 weeks, I continued with the diary. And that's quite valuable to me, to see how I felt when I started to write it and, you know, whether I had any idea of how it would turn out. But after about 6 weeks, I found it too self-referential. You can't really have a diary written by a woman who's writing a diary about herself. It's not how it was meant to be, so I stopped. And I go back, I write about interesting things, but I kept it for 40 years, and that's probably... I don't think I'll ever keep it sort of day-to-day that way.
If I can just beg to differ slightly, I think it may be true that it is badly handwritten, but it's not true that it's badly written.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
You know, there's just line after line, which it may not be literary, but it's certainly not illiterate. I mean, you know, people walk into a room and say, "I'm starving. Is there any champagne?" I mean, you know, that line is written.
That those were my teenage children.
How about? Okay, we'll do two. So how about your number one, and then number two can be the person over there, Judy. So you're next.
What about you? When did you realize that you wanted to be a writer? And was there any turning point in your life that made you want to write historical fiction? Historical novels?
I never decided to be a writer. I just was a writer. I was born writing. My mother kept everything I wrote. Which I'm glad to say seemed to have vanished, but I just, it's what I did. You know, some people can paint, alas, I can't sing, although opera's my passion, I can't sing. What else is there I might not be able to do?
You talk about Harold Pinter dancing like the Baryshnikov of East London.
Yes.
Can you dance?
I'm not the Fontaine of West London, though. No, and I just, that's what I always was. And when I left Oxford, because I've always supported myself, I went into publishing, because that was a good thing for a writer to do, to know how it all works. I always was a writer. History, was reading this book, Our Island Story, which I don't think is known here, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, it's now very old-fashioned and people despise it. It's still a frightfully good book. And I just read it when I was 4 and a half and thought, this is it. This is the best story.
Is they're asking what book?
I'm sorry?
Can you repeat the book? They're asking what book?
Oh, Our Island Story. Yeah. By H.E. Marshall, who was actually a woman who emigrated to Australia and wanted to tell the story of British history for her children, 1905, I think.
Okay, Judy, and then is there someone else who wants to line up for the next question after that? Yeah.
I think I've got it.
Great.
We bought your book tonight, so I didn't have a chance to read it. But I just wanted to ask in a way about Harold Pinter, because there were some remarkable... Well, he was remarkable. But you always heard about the pauses in Harold Pinter's writing. And we had twice the opportunity to see him perform in his own plays. Mm. And there were no pauses.
Well,
I mean,
very well said. You mean when he acted here
when
in
he
Old
acted,
Times?
He just acted right through the pause.
Yeah. I tell you what, the thing about the pauses, which he came to curse, but humorously, when he first wrote, it was long before I knew him, young man, he wanted to create a certain kind of speech and to make people wonder what lay behind the silences, which of course we all do it if we're having a difficult conversation, what we don't say is quite as important as what we do say. And this is what he wanted to convey. Then he felt that as the years went on, that actors, and encouraged by directors, to use the pauses as if they were beats in music, mm-hmm. without meaning anything. You know, there's no point to a pause if it doesn't mean anything, if there's nothing behind it. And so he just sort of started to treat them, you know, in a more relaxed way, including, as you've rightly said when he came here and acted in his own play with Liv Ullmann, Old Times.
And the other thing is that he wrote some of the most terrifying plays, but you never saw violence itself in them. The last time we saw him was in a play in a school, One for the Road.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yes, which was about a totalitarian country where they are getting information by torturing someone. And in the end, it's the worst torture of all because the child of this couple is killed, and Harold Pinter played...
But you don't know that, you see. I mean, you're absolutely right. In only one of Harold's 29 plays is there any violence on stage. And guess what? It's the first play, The Room, when he was 25 or 6. And ever after 28 plays, as you've rightly said, there's no physical violence on stage. And One for the Road is a perfect example. You get this very smooth man behind a wonderful desk, beautifully dressed, and these people, a husband, a wife, and a little boy brought in, but nothing happens to them there on stage, and it's incredibly menacing. And the last line, you never see anything happen to the little boy. He's just rather beguiling, and the torturer, as we know him to be, Nicholas, is very sweet to him and, you know, fun. But the last line, when the wretched husband's brought back and he's trying to say something, and he says, my son, and the torturer says, oh, don't worry about your son. He was, my emphasis, he was a little prick. And you realise he's gone. And when Harold read that play and acted it to me when he wrote it, I couldn't sleep for two nights. But you never see anything. I mean, that to me is art. Do you agree? Mm.
One of the things that the book makes clear is that Harold Pinter was an actor before he was a writer, and that, as the book puts it, as you put it, acting was the calling he chose.
Yes.
And writing and directing were the callings that chose him.
He loved acting, and he gave it up for 17 years, and then Michael Gambon didn't want to come to the States with Old Times, and I remember Harold turning from the telephone and saying, they want me... to go, what do you think? And I naturally said, go for it. And then there was a tryout of 10 days in St. Louis, and Harold's return to the stage was marked by the fact, and I'm going to get this wrong, but you know what I'm trying to say, the Cards played the Reds. Does that sound plausible?
Yes.
And
he was playing in St. Louis while their baseball team, which is kind of like a cricket team but with fewer runs,
but they
playing in the first game of the World Series.
Exactly. And it's a subscription theater, so that all the tickets had been bought, and the house was full of husbands who would rather have been absolutely anywhere than sitting in that theater. And so they had sort of headsets on, which every now and then squawked and screeched, you know. And the wives were going, shut up, it's a bit of play, you know. And then he came here, and I've pretty much forgotten the name of the theatre that I could find it, but he had a wonderful time.
Yeah, okay, we can take one more question, and yes, over there.
mentioned that the homecoming in context that Harold Pinter was, first of all, was a play about a family, and that he was an only child. So my question is, where do you think that play sprung from?
Well, I mean, I just don't know. I mean, I think with the point I was trying to make with creative artists, you can't always find somewhere from which it sprang. I mean, since we've mentioned Shakespeare, where did, you know, we know, I agree, so little about Shakespeare, but we know enough to know most of it, I mean, came out of his head, I guess. Don't you? I mean, I don't know. It works, of course, tremendously well in many different versions. At the Almeida Theatre in North London, which is a really good, sort of not quite a fringe theatre, it's more local theatre, but in 2008 they played it with Ruth, the alien wife brought in, with a very beautiful black actress called Jenny Jules. It was a fascinating take on it. I had only one problem, that for those who know the play, that when Max, the father, turns on this perfectly innocent wife and says, it's a long time since we had a scrubber in the house, and, you know, and sort of going on like that. Because she was black, it seemed to be to do with that, which, of course, it wasn't. It was to do with her being an alien and a threat. But still, I mean, you know, this is great plays can be done anyway, in any manner, I think, and you can always find something interesting.
I have a question and a request. The question is, in your book, you talk about Los Angeles as a place where people work too hard, go to bed too early, and don't really know how to hang out and have fun. Do
what?
You still believe this?
What, me? Did I say that? No, because I tell you what, I tell you exactly. Is this embarrassing? I tell you exactly. We belong to a sort of theatrical tradition that Harold would go to the theatre, I would work in that hotel, and then afterwards we would have supper, because that's what we did in London and what theatrical people do. Here we found, and I'm quite prepared to believe that organs stay up all night, but here we found everybody was working extremely hard and getting up very, very, very early in the morning, and therefore they did not want to stay and carouse after the theatre with us. Poor us.
I'm amazed that you could find some place that was still open after theatre to eat.
I can still tell you where it is for your information.
Please. And the request is, in the book, you have several of what then later became collected as six poems for A.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you might be so gracious as to close out the evening by reading one of them for us.
I'd love to read my very favorite, if I have to choose one. Some are too affecting for me to read, but this one, this poem is called It Is Here. What sound was that? I turn away into the shaking room. What was that sound that came in on the dark? What is this maze of light it leaves us in? What is this stance we take to turn away and then turn back? What did we hear? It was the breath we took when we first met. Listen, it is here.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.